All right, we're starting the Book of Esther.
Really glad to. This is a fun book. Unique in a number of ways, and kind of puzzling. And I'm excited to study with you because I know some of you have dug deeply into this book in the past and been helped by others, and so I'm grateful to be able to look at this with you. Let's begin with a prayer. Father in heaven, thank you for your word, for the teaching that's been recorded and preserved and now relayed in our own languages. Thank you that we have the opportunity to safely meet, to open up our own copies of the Bible, and to discuss and to help each other to see more clearly your will and your glory and goodness, your instruction, to be an encouragement to each other. Help us to be blessed by this exercise today, to be equipped for living life this week. Thank you, Father, for this time together. Please be with the classes upstairs. We're excited that young ones are learning about you and being taken further along than perhaps we were, given tools and information, and seeing the excitement in their faces helps us to appreciate the treasure that this is. So give them faith and courage and help them to fight the battles that you'll lead them through. In the name of Jesus we pray, amen. Okay. Book of Esther. When you think about the way the Hebrew Bible was arranged, you've got just a few books here at the very end. The writings, right? The Torah, the Nevi'im, Ketuvim, the Tanakh. That third section is the Psalms. Sometimes it's just referred to as the Law, the Prophets, and the Psalms. And so when you think about the Psalms, of course, the Book of Psalms is going to be there. But then you've got other writings like Proverbs. Ruth is in that last section, oddly enough. Not in the section with Joshua and Judges. Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes. So it's sort of just a hodgepodge of where do we put these things. But besides that, it's meant to point us forward to the way that God preserves his people, the way he fulfills his promises, and it concludes with the book of 2 Chronicles, what we call 2 Chronicles. And so there's sort of this hope that some David-like figure is going to come and rebuild and restore God's house and God's people and usher in this kingdom. The book of Esther is interesting. During the sermon, we were talking about how the wilderness is sort of a metaphor for the way we live our life. But if you think about captivity, it's also kind of another metaphor for it, that we're in a foreign territory and trying to figure out how do we engage in a world that doesn't know God, doesn't hold to his standards, doesn't obey his laws, and how do we interact in that kind of setting? So Esther gets us there. There are some curious things about the book of Esther. So when you think of the book of Esther, what comes to mind? I'm laying this open. This is a terrible question. We talked about asking questions in Bible class yesterday with the men. But what are you familiar with the book of Esther? What stands out as unique to you?
I think it's one of two books in the Bible that doesn't mention God.
I think it may be the only one.
No, I don't think Song of Solomon does.
It does toward the end, I believe, in chapter 8. There's one mention of Song of Solomon. But you're right. There's very few there. But Esther doesn't mention God at all. There may be one kind of inference toward God, which is what?
The theme.
Of course, the theme. Yes, the theme that we'll see. But they do fast.
Yes.
And what often goes with fasting?
Prayer.
So there's a sort of a reference to God.
Well, there's the Greek editions, which mention God a lot.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that. Okay, so the Septuagint, God's
mentioned. Yeah, there's like 100 more verses in the Greek version of Esther, and those mention God a lot.
Okay, I'm reading the English version, so. Anything else comes to mind with Esther?
She's the queen, eventually.
Yes, there's an eventual queen, so you have a king and queen figure here. April? Yes, Feast of Purim, right? If I'm saying that correctly. Which I think just happened, right? It's a feast day, and so what was coming up in my social media reels was Hebrew women talking about Purim. Like, you know you're a Bible person when stuff like that shows up in your social media reels. But it's like, what about Purim? What about this? And why do we do this? And why do we do that? So yes, it's a major feast for the Jews. What else? Noah.
This is one of those books, stories, where we see the curtain being pulled back a little bit, and we see God working in the background. A lot of times then we see, you know, God did this, and don't say how he did it. But here we kind of see all the elements, or a lot of elements, working to take come to the point.
Yeah. What one might call coincidences, time and chance, right? Really, if you're trusting God, you see how God is just working through all of that, through our mistakes, through evil, to bring about great good. He's glorified, his people are honored. And so it's kind of fun. It's just fun to read the story and see that. Anything else in the book of Esther? Significant.
So the young woman
Yeah. And so we like to be favored. We like to enjoy that. One question that comes up, at least came to me recently when I was studying Esther, was what do I do with that? You know, we like to be liked. We like to prosper. But then the question comes, okay, as a child of God, what do I do with the ways God has blessed me? Do I just enjoy it, or do I do something with it?
Esther and Ruth are the only books named after women. Is that, I don't think there's, I guess Judith doesn't count.
So. Judith doesn't, not my English Bible, yeah. So you've got Ruth and Esther. Okay, good, Lynn?
It's also interesting that it's taking place outside of the land of
Israel. Yeah.
The nation of Israel.
Yeah, it's not the only book that does that. Of course, you've got Ezekiel and Daniel. So it is a captivity book, but it's one that probably celebrates how God is restoring the people, so even though they're still in captivity. Again, it's kind of this metaphor. Nithin.
One thing is like the disobedience of Israel previously when God said to take out Amalekites, which they didn't do, and they see the effect.
Okay. Yeah, I think we're going to see some of that. There's some debate about talking about Haman, the Agagite. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably the case, but there is some debate about that, which is interesting. So yes, but you do certainly see a thread of why are they in this trouble in the first place, whether it's in captivity or whether it's they have this enemy. Well, it's because of previous disobedience. And so God can restore us and forgive us, but there may still be lingering consequences to previous sin.
Yeah, I don't mean to correct you, but I think, you know, Cyrus was the one who ended the captivity, and Ahasuerus comes after him, so I think it's probably more accurate to say this is a diaspora book than a captivity book, because you know not all the
sure.
Jews went back.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that this is years after, right? When you're thinking about the timeline, you've got Zerubbabel, and then you've got Esther, and then Ezra and Nehemiah. So this is certainly after the Jews return home, but there's still the diaspora, right? However you say that word, they're still dispersed amongst the nations. So if I use the word captivity, this is during the period of the return, but the people are still not in their homeland. So misnomer on my part. Thank you for that. David? You look like you want to say something.
It depends on how you define the captivity. But I think it's Ezra and Nehemiah Nehemiah was insolvent. They were calling themselves, we are slaves.
Yeah.
We are not free. Even though they are in, but in that case, then captivity will run on even until
Jesus' time.
Yeah,
there's still kind of a view of that being under Roman oppression, that's why it's such a big deal the Messiah would come to deliver them. Yeah, so you kind of use those words interchangeably there. Yeah, pause on the other hand. We don't want to give too much. Is this a hand?
No.
Okay. Some people raise hands differently. This or this. So like I'm trying to keep track of everybody raising their hand. Okay, we don't often take the time to do this, but today we're going to read this section. We have the time to do that, and I'd like to do that with you. So beginning in Esther chapter 1, have someone read verses 1 through 9, please. Go ahead, Layla.
Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, that Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which is at the citadel in Susa, In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes in attendance, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed his riches and his royal glory and his splendor and his great majesty for many days, 180 days. When those days were completed, he gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. They were hanging with fine white violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings on marble columns, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, with royal wine, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Queen Vashti also gave the banquet for the women in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus.
Okay, pause here for just a moment, and you see that Ahasuerus is, he's living it up. So what are some of the details that indicate how lavish this party is, or parties, rather?
Well, I mean, he's able to show his greatness for many days.
Yes, yeah, the whole purpose is to display his magnificence here. Ethan?
Well, he describes a lot of, the decorations and things, and how there was couches of gold and silver, and there were all these mosaics with different kinds of like jewels and things like that. So it's even uses the, well, at least my translation uses the word lavished in verse 7, so
okay,
you can see it's very lavish.
How long does the party last?
A year.
Okay, this is a long party. Okay, what are they doing? So 180 days, and then after that's done, you got kind of a follow-up party. This is the after-party party, and it's the seven-day-long party. So this is just, it's just ongoing festivity. There's an indication in history that Persia's not doing so well right now, actually. They've been losing some to the Greeks, and this is a bit of a retreat. So that may indicate some of what's happening mentally, emotionally, with Ahasuerus, is he's feeling a little fragile. And so what does he do when he's feeling fragile? Throws off his feathers back here, starts strutting around and saying, look how great I am. Okay. So either way, though, he's got his feast, and how much are they supposed to drink? Whatever they want. Okay, so verse 8, some have said there's no compulsion. I mean, we won't make you drink. No, I think it's like, don't feel like you have to stop. Just drink, drink, and drink as much as you want. Now, meanwhile, Queen Vashti is also giving a feast for the women, and so this is just everybody's partying. Okay? This sounds like a good place you want to live? I mean, imagine for just a moment that Congress says we're just canceling Congress for a while, and the President and the Supreme Court say we're taking a break. Okay? This has been really hard on us, and so for the next 6 months, we're going to celebrate America. Right? And we're going to throw parties and parades and public demonstrations of our military might and feasting. And when it's all done, we'll let you have a week off. Okay? And that was, would that be good and great? Actually, in some ways, it might be kind of nice if they just stopped. But we would who's in charge here? What is going on? And the world's just loving the world. That's kind of the environment that these Jews are in right now in Persia. Okay? Other thoughts or comments through verse 9? Observations? Okay, let's continue reading here. Get a volunteer to read 10 through the end of the chapter here, a little bit longer. Lynn?
On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Bizba, Arbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, The men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people.
One of the interesting things about the book of Esther is there is very little, if any, divine commentary on what is happening. And so we're going to try hard not to insert our judgment into the text, but we are called to make some evaluations here. We've got to look and see and say, okay, does this fit with what we see of God's wisdom? Does this stand in obedience with God's laws? And so we're going to have to try to look and see. But God doesn't offer any kind of approval or disapproval. It's just recorded. Just like we don't see, and so God sent, you know, a dream, or God made it so that, like, it doesn't say that, though you trust that sort of thing's happening. So we're going to have to try hard to see, okay, what's going on here? Foolishness, wisdom-wise, what's happening? So, Sabbath day, and the king has been partying now for 6 months, plus a week, and drinking with no compulsion. He just, whatever he wants to drink, he drinks. And so, in my head, there's very much a slur in his voice, and he says, bring out Queen Vashti. And bring her out how? With her royal crown. Why? How did she get this job in the first place, by the way?
She's beautiful.
She's gorgeous. What does it say about her?
She's nice,
lovely to look at.
Yeah, lovely to look at. She had a great personality. She's really wise, gives him lots of good advice. Actually, we're going to find out that maybe she has something more to her than her beauty. But bring her out in her royal array. Why? What's happening here? Yeah. Like, is this supposed to make Vashti feel good?
No.
So, husband's drunk, his buddies are drunk, and they say, bring out my wife. Okay? So, I asked you in question number two to evaluate the king's decree in response to Vashti. You understand the unwritten question? You're having to evaluate who? Vashti. So, how does Vashti respond to this?
No.
She just refuses. Can you do that to the king? Apparently you can. And what happens to her? Does she lose her life? No. What does she keep? Her dignity. Some have suggested that the king's really wanting her to come out and wear only her crown. That's what some have suggested. I don't think you have to take it that far. I think it's just she realizes what the king is after, and she's not going to be part of this. And so she's going to stay with the women, he's going to be with the men, and they're going to be dignified. There's something to that. Okay. So, Observer, you had a hand up here?
Yeah. I guess, you know, we can take from this, like, the... I agree. I don't think Ahasuerus is being very, you know, he's fulfilling his ends of the obligations in their marriage. You know, he he says that, you know, she has to come out, she refuses, and, you know, you can't, he's angry, and, you know, you can't just say, to your wife, well, you didn't listen to me and I'm angry at you, so bye, you're like, I'm done with you. You know, I mean, you could imagine some scenario, you know, where a husband doesn't, you know, a wife won't, you know, listen to her husband, and her husband's like, well, now she's going to tell all their her friends that she's not, you know, following me, and then they're not going to want to be led by their husbands. But like, that's not a reason to say, well, I'm just going to go find a new wife. Like that, yeah, that's not how that works.
And wasn't that kind of a question that Jesus was asked in his day about marriage and divorce? Can you divorce your wife for any reason? And there were some rabbis who were saying that, yeah, if you find something displeasing in her, then you can just put her away and then marry somebody else. So do you see that sort of thing happening today? Of course you do. Of course you do. So, I mean, this is interesting. I don't, like, so how does a wife tell her husband, no, this is not respectable, this is not honorable, you're making me very vulnerable here, how do you do that? And she just refuses. Now, if there are marital disputes between two people in a very low income situation, kind of the lower end of society, you think, well, yeah, they're on the lower end of society, kind of expect that. But if the president and his wife are having marital disputes, oh, you're not supposed to do that. Suddenly this looks really bad on you, this looks bad on the country. And then if they're having marital disputes, then what do the underlings think? They're having disputes, so we can have disputes, and so everyone's kind of upset here, the men at least are, because if the king loses respect and she gets away with it, then what's going to happen to us and our wives? That's kind of the major thrust here. Who are they concerned about? Not the king, not the country, about themselves. Okay, do you think you have a follow-up?
Yeah, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, they hear the biblical command for wives to submit to their husbands, and they think it means, well, the wife just has to, like, be bossed around and, like, do everything he says. But like you see here, you know, if he's asking her to do something like that's, you know, doesn't you know, respect her dignity and is ungodly, then, you know, she, that, like, that's not what submit to your husband really means.
Yeah, it's Ephesians 5:22 comes into this, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. And so if my husband is asking me to do something, telling me to do something that's not befitting a godly woman, right? It's not in keeping with my commitment to the Lord. I keep my commitment to the Lord. But it may not mean that I suffer dishonor or humiliation. I'm married to this person, and so we're one flesh, and this is going to hurt. So that's a tough situation to be in. She's not in an easy situation. So submit, yes. Obey, yes. But here, she says no. Other observations? April? Yes.
And he's enraged, and then later on, it's going to say when his rage had abated, then he remembered what he had decided. And so, even separate from what Vashti was doing, like even if it was a different scenario,
right,
where there actually was a problem, he's not handling it well.
No,
he's reacting in rage in a drunken mood with just people who, like you talked about, maybe he's feeling fragile. I think these officials sure sound like they're feeling fragile.
Absolutely.
And
yes.
So, his whole decision-making process is
just
very
hard. It reminds me very much of Herod when he swears to do whatever the girl asks, and then when he finds out what she asks, he goes, oh, because of my oath and because of the people who hear. So he's got a safe face is what he feels like. The humble thing is the wise thing. There's so many times throughout Proverbs where wisdom is linked in with humility. Folly is linked in with pride. And so if I'm feeling defensive, if I'm feeling frustrated, if I feel like someone's attacking me and no one's respecting me or honoring me like they should, get ready. You're about to do something dumb and foolish. Okay. Tammy.
I was just curious as to why, I guess, this is not bad, but like, why didn't Vashti lose her life? As a result, or is that like something we cannot?
I really don't know. It's a good question. I don't know if there's something in the prenuptials, you know, like, hey, you can't behead me. I'm not sure. And honestly, and I'd say that kind of in jest, but we're going to find out as we go that they had laws that once the law was made, you can't change the law. So if they wanted to adjust things, they had to make a different law that countered that law. And so it's a lot of play with some of that. So I'm not sure. And whose daughter was she? So are we going to make somebody? I don't know. Those are good questions. No.
One of the biggest problems when studying history, being a historian, is that a lot of times we tend to read over our culture onto somebody else's culture.
Sure.
And then get it really wrong.
Yeah.
In this culture, if I remember, the Persian culture, the women had a lot more power than back in the Jewish culture did.
Okay.
And I think that's one reason they kind of maybe highlighted some of this in the book, is saying, you know, that she did.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you kind of got to take that into account.
Interesting, yeah. I'm not as familiar with that, but that may be so. I know that was so amongst the Greeks.
That's
so,
right. Yeah. The Corinthian, you know, that similar circumstance was kind of happening with the church.
All the same, we'll see at least in the I'm not disagreeing with that point at all, but we'll see at least in the story of Esther that Esther as a queen is going to be fearful about coming before the king because he does have the ability to have her executed. So this is a risky move on Vashti's part, especially considering that he's drunk and angry. This could go really badly, but she makes the decision. Yes?
I find it interesting that the question he asks him for 15 is, according to the law, what is to be done?
Right.
And the answer is not the law. Like, there isn't a law about this. That's not on the table. What it is the response is, let me protect my interests. So there is kind of this reflection of maybe there was the beginning of, let's figure out lawfully what we're supposed to do, but there is no precedent, and so what takes over is this selfishness of self-protection.
Yes, that is interesting. I think we actually see a little more than that. What does this tell you about Ahasuerus?
He doesn't know the law.
He doesn't know what to do. He is a bad leader. I don't think we're going to see him make one single decision on his own this entire book except for one. He doesn't know what to do. And so he's going to go to the other leaders and say, all right, guys, what do we do? And are they going to make decisions that are in his best interest? No, it's in their best interest. And so he is a lame duck, right? Meredith.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't take much positive marriage advice from this situation.
Yeah.
The guy's pointing the finger. She's disrespecting me, and what is everybody going to think? Like,
right.
Well, what does everybody think of you already? You're with the party president.
Yes.
There's not really a lot of respect going on, except for the guys that are also partying with him.
Yeah.
So...
Every now and then I do write quotes from people in my margins that might make it. Persian party president. Okay. I like it. Okay, so yeah, the noble women this very day in verse 18, the noble women of Persia Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials. There'll be contempt and wrath and plenty. That's their main concern. So here he is. He's merry with wine. The heart of the king is merry with wine, which means he's out of his mind. She refuses. He's enraged. His anger burns within him, but he doesn't know what to do. And so he goes to others. And then they're making rules that are in their own best interest. And so they're concerned about contempt amongst the nation, about chaos. We're going to see time and time again that their best efforts to rule the kingdom and prevent chaos actually have the opposite effect. Okay, this is going to have the opposite effect of what the king wants, because as April mentioned, when he is no longer drunk, he's going to remember and go, oh, I kind of miss my wife. So... got to be really careful. I mean, it's not a big point, but an important one. Be careful about your decisions. There you go. And then finally, look at verse 19. Let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. Define better. What are they looking for? Demi?
She will always obey every command.
Okay. She will be the trophy wife. She will stand beside you and look gorgeous. Maybe we can get a newer model. And she'll look even more gorgeous-er. And she'll always do what you say. Is that what he's going to get? Ironically, no. He's not going to get that. He's going to get someone who's gorgeous, not getting better. But like someone who's just going to kind of stand there silently. By the end of the book, he definitely gets someone better, but someone who's going to stand beside him and actually help him to rule in a good, godly, helpful way. So he does get someone better, but not because of these guys. Okay? Other observations. There was a hand here. Niffin.
The king is the one.
I have to go back and look in my notes, and I didn't write that down. I think so, yes.
Historically speaking, he's the bad king. Not bad.
Yes.
He went for the war with the Greeks and lost, and that's where the decline came. So the king always says that he's not a man that of a good character. I mean, strong character.
Yeah, and even just within the story itself, we're going to see he's very, very weak in character. Then.
I just wanted to highlight the phrase in verse 13, the wise men who knew the times. Like, that kind of stood out to me if we were assessing this king's character. Like, he is basing his morality on what the culture is today.
Okay. Yeah, and when they tell him what works today, verse 21, it pleases him and the princes, and so they write letters and send it throughout the whole of the royal provinces, every province in its own script. And so, okay, done, and everyone knows we're supposed to obey our husbands. Husbands have the rule. Just a quick note here. I think this is reflective of something that you see in Genesis 3. So if you look briefly back to Genesis 3, Paul is going to make the point, both in 1 Corinthians 11 and 1 Timothy 2, that the man is the head of the woman, not because of the fall, but because of created order. Man was made first, and then the woman. So a husband leading the home is not because of sin in the first place. And therefore, because we're in this new covenant with Christ, new heavens and new earth, new creation, forgiveness of sins, that the husband no longer needs to be the head. But that's not the case that Paul makes. He says in 1 Timothy 2, 1 Corinthians 11, that it's because of created order. However, in Genesis 3 and in verse 16, one of the consequences of sin, God says to the woman, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Think about what her work is. Her work is supposed to be like, okay, bearing fruit. Adam's going to be bearing fruit by working the ground, right? He's supposed to, that is his work. She's supposed to be bearing fruit, having children, being a helpmeet to her husband. So God's going to curse the ground, which is what his work is, and then he's going to see the consequences of her relationship with her husband. And so you see the next thing, your desire shall be for your husband, he shall rule over you. That's been interpreted in myriads of ways over the years. I'm going to suggest this, that God is saying that because of insecurities and living in a fallen world, the woman is going to be tempted to try to manipulate and draw her husband after her, to try to get the husband in some way to do what she wants him to do because that'll make her feel safe. She's going to try to control. And he, to counter that, is going to be tempted to rule over, to dominate, and to control her. And that's not the way God designed it. He meant it to be this mutually beneficial relationship where the husband is taking authority as a service to his wife and being responsible, and she is a help in submitting to him. It's supposed to be this really wonderful relationship, but because of our insecurities and because of sin, we think that we need to grab that back from God and do it our way. And so wives are going to be tempted to do that. And men are going to be tempted to, I got to protect my honor. I got to prove I'm the man. I better be respected in my house. And we get defensive about any kind of supposed apparent threats to our authority. And we're falling into this and we do that. So I can't do that. I can't afford to do that. Because my fear and my insecurity, guess what it's going to do to her? Make her feel afraid and insecure. Now she's responsible for her response. But I'm going to try to lead. And she's over here trying to manipulate and pull. That's going to communicate, well, I can't trust you to lead. And so now you've got a mess. So each one's responsible for their own response here. So I think that's highlighted in this first chapter of Esther, where the men are saying, we're going to lose respect in our homes because she's going to rebel. And like, say what you want to about Vashti. I think she did a wise thing here and suffered consequences. But this move just highlights the insecurity that they're feeling. Okay, Noah?
I agree with what you just said there about that. But to simplify, it's about power struggle. And
yeah.
The same power struggle is reflected in how we relate to each other,
sure.
How we relate to our government, how we, that's what God is constantly talking about. The big power struggle is how we relate to God.
Yeah. Yeah. Ephesians 5, before you ever get into husbands and wives, submit to one another. And that doesn't mean that I don't have roles in certain spheres where I am in authority or I am in submission. But the idea of submitting one to another, it's I'm giving up power, like Philippians 2. Okay. Nathan?
I think we have some confusion between order and hierarchy, because God says
Could you help me, because maybe I'm confused, the difference between order and hierarchy? How would you explain that?
Like order in the sense God created, and order where men, then woman. It's not like he's powerful and woman is powerless.
Oh, I see. I see.
But he sometimes look everything in respect to hierarchy.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's God setting hierarchy, like God is dogs and men or women. So we seek to power, not to order.
I think I see what you're saying. So yeah, it is a hierarchy in the sense of position, but not in power. Is that fair? So it's not
So the word hierarchy goes out of the picture because it's just an order which God created. This is how it has to work because God created in a way.
Yeah, just like the wife is not less valuable
than
the husband.
The value, only thing is God created the order.
Yes. Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Similarly to what Nick was saying, Jesus is in submission to God.
Yes,
that doesn't make him less valuable. That doesn't make him unimportant or his work is
he's less God somehow.
Anything like that. But
right.
He was in submission and he was
yes.
very adamant that he's going to do what the Father says. But it's not he's not under God's thumb or just completely vulnerable. I think that's a good picture of what submission is supposed to be.
Yeah. He's not less, he's under. Yeah. Okay. Same thing with husbands and wives.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe another way of thinking about it is like, you know, both men and women, you know, God made men in his image, both male and female.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not like there's just one person has, you know, just less of God into their image than the other, you know, one.
Yes, right.
But it's really more so that, like, just the different roles. There's different roles, but you know, both working together as the way God intended.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. More to be said on that. Just one further point. Thinking about leadership, it's so often the case in the Bible that God chooses to make someone a leader who may not be what we would consider to be the best leader. Like, I can make a case for Moses being like the best guy chosen, but Moses is like, I'm not. Like, there's somebody to choose somebody else. David, you know, Saul was obviously the best one by our standards, and that didn't go well. And so to think I have a position of authority and therefore that means I'm the most qualified, no, I'm just qualified because God chose me. He put me in a position. And so to look down on others and say you're less qualified or you're just less is missing the point. Authority is bestowed. It's the order that God puts in place. Now, let's get to chapter 2 because there are some really interesting applications from this one. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young man who had attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the citadel under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Let's get a volunteer to read 5 through 11, please. Ethan?
Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put into the custody of Haggai, who had charge of the woman. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai was walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her.
All right, and then Meredith, would you mind finishing up 12 through 18, please?
Sure. Now, when the tournament's young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows. 6 months with oil and myrrh, and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Sheshgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go in to the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, to his royal palace, in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty.
That finished up through verse 18?
Yes.
Okay. It reads just differently enough. I'm like, okay. All right. So meet Mordecai, meet Esther. One of my favorite stories is some of you know Sister Lee's Stories for Little Children. This is old school. This is like 1950. But if you know Bob and Sandra Waldron, some material we've used here, the 17 periods of Bible history, that came from some work by Bob and Sandra Waldron. Sandra's mother was Sister Lee. Her actual name was Otha Lowe. But anyway, she wrote a lot of little children's stories, and she just loved telling kids stories. And one of my favorite stories is she sat in a car, they're driving a long way with her grandson, and she says, do you know the story about Mordecai? And he says, no, I don't. And so she spends about an hour telling the whole story of Esther. And he says, oh yeah, I know that one. We call him Mordecai. So the little boy lets her tell the whole story. Like, so pronunciation, look, Mordecai, you know, I believe it's pronounced Sheashgaz, okay? Like, I don't know some of this. But the names are interesting. So Mordecai, do you see a name in that at all? Yes?
I just wanted to, when we were kids, we had a video game with a character named Mordecai in it, and we said his name really wrong. I think we said like more DCI. Like we were way off.
Yeah, it's way off. It's easy to do. But do you see a name within that name? Okay, English, yes. That's sure. Marduk. So who's Marduk?
It's the Babylonian.
Babylonian god. Esther? Ishtar. Okay, so these are Babylonian Persian names. Okay, so they have an identity that's under wraps. Do you see that? Why? Didn't Cyrus say all the Jews can go home? Why is this under wraps? Don't the people know that Mordecai's a Jew? We're going to find out later that Haman's like, who is that guy Mordecai? Well, he's a Jew. People know. So why this? No, these are their names. These are their names, either given names or names that society they've taken on in society. Ethan?
Well, if I'm remembering the Greek version correctly, I think God had told Mordecai not to reveal Esther's identities.
Okay. Let me suggest that sometimes we're afraid that we're going to be mistreated or treated differently because people know that we serve God. Has that ever come up? Afraid to mention God's name in a workplace? Afraid to mention that you're a Christian? That you're going to church on the weekend? Sunday? What are your plans? It's an interesting dilemma. We live in a world that is very much against God and against truth. And I go, how much do I give away? This is going to look awkward. What opportunities am I going to be denied? What promotions am I going to be looked over for? And how is this going to work? Am I going to be looked at differently? Are people going to start judging me? Or maybe pull back and we won't be friends anymore? How does this work? And they're experiencing this kind of thing. We know they are because that's what the story's about. You've got God's people in a foreign land. How do you do this? And so Mordecai gives Esther the advice, don't tell anybody. What do you think about that?
Known in the unit in charge of him is afraid he's going to be in trouble. Like, there was a fear, but he, you know, he's praying at the window, even though it's against the law. I think that this is not courage here in Esther.
Yeah, is it out and out wrong? No. I don't think I can say it's out and out wrong, but I can say for sure that it is, we're going to see some growth from this. There's some weakness here. In fact, and I tried my hardest for a long time to see it some other way. This compromise on identity, what does it lead to by the end of the chapter for Esther?
She'd be queen.
Well, she's queen, but what happened before that? She's, that's a nice way to say it. She spends a night with the king, doesn't she? She is taken into the harem. Now, does she have a choice? Well, did Daniel have a choice? This is a dilemma, okay? Again, the Bible is not offering any kind of evaluation about this. We're just reading it and going, ooh, that's a hard spot to be in. But she gets taken in and goes through the beauty treatments and the process, and she just goes and spends a night with the king and goes from one harem to the other harem. She belongs now to the women who belong to the king. And he makes her queen, yes, but there's some compromise that occurs here. And I don't know how to read it otherwise. Observations, questions. Saranya? A strategy on her part? Or? Oh. Maybe I've underestimated his wisdom here, perhaps. If so, he's taking a little bit of a gamble with Esther's life. But I think he's at least trying to keep her out of trouble. Okay? At least that's part of it. He's responsible for caring for her.
Mm-hmm.
April?
So she's afraid of this interfering with her progress, but if it's maybe something where the progress should have been interfered with, like, God had a lot of laws about sexual immorality,
yes.
Who marries who,
mm-hmm.
And, I mean, because it's not just like a blind date or a beauty pageant. I mean, they're each going in for a night. I don't see a way to see this as right.
I don't either. And I tried a long time. Just like, no, it's got to be okay. It's got to be okay. And it's just not. It's just not. If you're going to try to convince me otherwise, you're not going to. No, but if you can show me from the text otherwise, but even like marrying a foreigner, that's not going to work. That's against the law here. I mean, she is caught in a really difficult circumstance, no doubt about it. What I want to highlight here before we kind of wrap up, and we've got several hands I'll get to you. What we're going to see is God working through hard situations, through unfortunate choices, through sin. And whether it's mine or this world that we live in that's broken by sin, God is going to be able to get to a good end by the time we're done. And I think that's what we're meant to take away from this, is that, yeah, there are a lot of missteps along the way. I'm going to grow along the way. We're going to see Esther grow a lot in this story. But God doesn't need me to get it perfectly in order to have a happily ever after. I think that's beautiful. Okay. Linda, do you have a hand up? No? No, you've had a hand up for a while.
You pretty much said it. I think this is a perfect example of how God shows that can work as much despite as because of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not that Mordecai's a faithless man. I think he's trying
to
be responsible. But we've seen, haven't we seen Abraham do something out of fear that he shouldn't have, and David do something out of fear he shouldn't? Like, we've seen it again and again. So again, when you're reading the Bible, don't go looking for heroes. Read people and look for God. Okay, Michelle.
Yes, and that's what I love about God's word, because it shows people who are real, like you and I. They make errors, they sin, and He doesn't hide that from us. He shows their humanity, and then He shows us how He uses their weaknesses and their humanity. Like,
yes.
Okay,
yes. Yeah. And
in Mordecai's case, he maybe wanted the best for us because he was, in a sense, a father to the actor.
Right.
Her father died, and so maybe in his mind he thought by putting her there, she becoming queen, that might have been a good thing for her, so he did what he did. But
yes.
God used that choice.
Yeah, and I also, what I'm seeing, and I may be wrong about this, verse 8, this is an edict, the women are gathered, and they are taken. I don't know that Mordecai and Esther have a choice in this. I think this is just done. And so you're a beautiful girl, you're going to the castle. That's just it. Now, other translations may read differently. What is, okay.
Verse 7, it says, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Well, maybe that's not.
Yeah, I think that's, he's,
that's
he, I think he raised her.
Yeah.
It's easy to read that and think, oh, he took her too.
Yeah.
But I think it's just him raising her. Okay, other thoughts or questions before we wrap up? Donnie?
Yeah, I was just going to say, historical narratives are historical narratives. They just tell you.
Tell the story.
Tell the story. You interpret in whichever way that you want. But as Michelle mentioned, it's interesting to see what happens with what God's people.
Yeah.
That's one. Secondly, is the fact that you see God's permissive will, or in scripture you have God's permissive will and God's efficacious will. In which case, God is going to use situation.
Yeah.
It may not be beautiful, it may not be more than right, but
yeah,
his will is accomplished nonetheless. Right? If you look at Jacob and Esau, I mean, there's so many scenarios in particularly with them, where you see God's will being done. But it reminds us that humanity is not divinity.
Yeah. And by the way, this is not any way for me to try to cast blame on Esther here. I don't think she's in that position. It's kind of similar to David and Bathsheba. With David's sin, it's not David's and Bathsheba's sin. It's David's sin. She's essentially raped. So when you get to this story, I'm not trying to say, Esther's wrong here. She's in a tough spot. But like you said, it's messy and it's not comfortable. So God's going to be working through this. You can't really offer any kind of judgment until you get to the end of the story. And isn't that often the case? April?
At the same time, you should say, like, they were taken. They had no choice. I mean, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We were taken. We were told we had to. We're going to be killed otherwise.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
Yeah.
And so I struggle to say,
I did too.
Just because the king said so, just because they were taken,
yeah,
she had to.
No, yeah. As far as, like, spending the night with the king,
right,
like, standing up and saying, I can't, I'm a Jewess. I mean, at some point you got to make the call and say, this is the line. And to go further is to honor man above God. And so sometimes that's hard to discern, but we've got to have a line somewhere. One more, and then we'll quit for the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just something that just speaks to the concept of survival and what people, I mean, you know, we live on this earth, we're trained and you know, just different things, people, nature, what have you, you know, you're just thinking about what you're trying to do for survival. And so, like, you know, yeah, I mean, while it's not perfect, I mean, I think it one thing to consider, I guess, or, you know, especially when we read scripture, is like, you know, what is really, like, the heart behind what you're trying to do for survival. And we see in some cases that people are trying, you know, they become more and more concerned about the things that they do for God's glory as opposed to just, you know, just trying to accomplish their personal goals and do what they want.
Quick story on that, and then we'll say a prayer and wrap up. I know of cases, and I'm thinking of one in particular right now, where a young man was raised in a very abusive home and learned to steal and lie and hide to survive. He would have starved to death otherwise. I know that situation.